Thanks for the opportunity to speak here. I gave a similar talk a few months ago to the condensed matter folks at Princeton, and so I'm hoping that this talk is going to be relatively pedagogical. What I've tried to do here is I've tried to add a little bit more to the condensed matter side of the story, because I know there are fewer of you in the room today who understand that side of the story well. Of course, I don't understand that side of the story that well myself, being relatively new to it. And I just found out what a lecture means yesterday for the purposes of this. But even so, I think it should be, it's not a Blackboard talk, but it should be close to a lecture. So I listed a few of these papers on the wiki, three of them. So if you're interested in what I say today and you want to learn a little bit more, I recommend reading these papers. And I've added one extra paper at the bottom here, which I'm going to talk very little about today, but which Sean Hartnell and I wrote last month, and sort of a natural continuation of the story here. So the talk divides up into three parts, roughly. There's the sort of condensed matter side of the story, which is the first third, under the title here, Applications and Motivation. The middle part of my talk is, I hope, a gentle pedagogical review of this ADS-CFT correspondence. I know there's some real experts in the room, but probably there's some other people who know very little about it at all, although I guess you heard some talks, or some of you who didn't arrive recently heard talks by Larry Yaffe and Ed Shuryak about this. And the third part of the talk is new stuff, which makes this less of a lecture and more of a talk, but we bury that at the end, and it's all very interesting, so I hope you'll follow along. All right, so to begin with, I'd like to begin with this notion of a quantum phase transition. So this is not a thermal phase transition. It's a phase transition between different quantum phases, or phases of matter at zero temperature. So where a thermal phase transition is driven by thermal fluctuations, by T fluctuations, a quantum phase transition I have in mind is something that's driven by the uncertainty principle, by H-bar fluctuations. And you only access it by varying some physical parameter, so a coupling constant, a magnetic field, a pressure, at zero temperature. And so here's this diagram. I mean, what I know about phase transitions comes mainly from talking with Subir Sashdev and reading his nice book on the subject. And he always draws this diagram, so I'll draw it too. So on the vertical axis, you have temperature. On the horizontal axis, some coupling constant. There are two phases for some system. In a gauge theory context, you know, maybe one phase could be a Higgs phase, another phase could be a Coulomb phase, and at some critical coupling, some GC, there's a phase transition between them. So there's some different order parameters typically describing these two phases, and then some critical point down at the bottom. And then as you increase the temperature, being careful to stay close to this critical coupling, maybe you're not in a region that's well described by either of these phases. You're in some quantum critical region, some QCR quantum critical region, where if you had an effective field theory description of this quantum critical point, you would be able to describe or predict properties in this finite temperature region well. Sort of basic hand waving here about. So these blue lines would actually be phase transition lines. And I guess, you know, once you get to finite temperature, these would actually be thermal phase transitions. You only have the quantum critical point down here. These black lines are just some guide to the eye where this quantum critical effective field theory might be a good description of what's going on physically.
Can you give us another example from condensed matter?
I will, yes.
And second order transitions, or doesn't
matter? What do I have in mind?
Now the zero temperature transition is some kind of multi-critical point.
Yeah, it may not be describable by a single order parameter. You may have different order parameters on these two phases, and so this sort of standard first order, second order may not apply.
Continuous.
Is it?
what if you want to have a quantitative associate key description?
Just because you need large correlation lengths and so to control that?
Yeah, but there can be quantum phase transitions at first level.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Examples. So there are conjectures that there are many important physical systems which have these quantum critical points. And again, as I was emphasizing, there may be some effective field theory description which is valid at, say, small distances and temperature pulled away from this quantum critical point. And this region might be in some experimentally accessible regime. And some examples that I had in mind, well, maybe there are superfluid insulator transitions in thin films. There's this long involved story about fractional quantum Hall states or quantum Hall states and transitions between those, which people think might be controlled by quantum critical points. And there's conjectures in the literature, although this is all debated to some extent, that high temperature underdoped superconductors, temperatures not too much above the critical temperature, might be well described by some kind of quantum critical effective field theory. And evidence for this comes from, say, this observation of the Nernst effect, which I'll come back to in a few minutes. Temperature zero. We'll get to that. So here's a picture that I borrowed from a PRL by Haviland, Liu, and Goldman. I'm sorry, the quality is not so great. Hopefully you can make it out. But on the horizontal axis here I have temperature. On the vertical axis here I have a resistivity. And what these plots are, they're plots of a thin film of bismuth, as I understand it. And what you do for each of these lines is you vary the thickness of the film. So as you go up here, the film gets thinner and thinner from something like 74 angstroms at the bottom up here to, say, 4 angstroms at the top. And as you decrease the temperature here, you see that for the thick films, the resistivity goes way down. So you have some kind of superconductor-like behavior or at least very conductive behavior at low temperatures, whereas for thinner films the resistivity goes way up. And in the middle, for some critical thickness, you have some say quantum critical point, maybe right here, which has some associated characteristic conductivity. And as you vary the thickness, you go from one phase to the other. So this is one example of a system which, so if you're interested in the behavior here, for some here, it might be well described by some effective field theory that describes this quantum critical point. So this is sort of the graph I showed before, but on its side.
I
think effectively the system here is two-dimensional, as far as I understand. But in this region, even at say 74 angstroms, it's still effectively a two-dimensional electron gas. Or you see, that the knee is very soft.
I think it's disorder driven, the strength of the region, so when you change, the width of the change is a lot of disorder. And I think these lines, so actually in super small dimensions, at finite temperature, you don't have any phase transitions. So actually, I think that was okay. But there's still the idea that there's some region in the middle here at finite temperature where you can use the finite temperature. Instead of one of the positive parts of the description.
But so any transition continued down to zero temperature would be a zero temperature termed quantum.
Any phase, sorry.
If you have a phase transition at finite temperature,
yeah.
And then you go lower the temperature to zero so that you can still go from one phase to another. Is it called quantum or is this?
I think so, yeah.
What's the meaning of quantum phase? How do you call the U1 transition at zero temperature?
The U1? Which U1
transition?
I'm not sure how to answer that question. And the other example I wanted to give was this high PC superconductor. So there are many of these guys. Let's just pick one of them, this lanthanum cuprate, which if you don't dope it, is an insulator. And the physics of this guy is essentially 2D, at least above the superconducting phase transition. Why? Because these copper atoms, which are critical for this superconductivity, from the crystal structure, they arrange themselves into these square lattices on separated sheets, say one electron per copper atom, and they set themselves up in this ferromagnetic state that's insulating. And then what you can do is you can start removing some of the lanthanum atoms and replacing them with strontium, which dopes this guy with holes. So not all of the sites are now filled. And in this doped case, you see superconducting behavior. So I have here a plot of some experimental data for this compound as a function on the x-axis of the strontium doping and on the y-axis of the temperature. And so you see down here this dark blue, this is the superconducting dome. So down here at low temperatures in this mid-range of doping, you get superconducting behavior. And then above this, you still see some remnants of whatever was causing the superconductivity. You still see some rather strange behaviors and various observable quantities. One of which is this anomalously large Nernst effect. So what is the Nernst effect? A Nernst effect, you apply some thermal gradient to your sample, you apply some magnetic field, which is, say, perpendicular to the thermal gradient, and you measure an induced voltage. You measure an electric field, which is parallel to V cross delta T. And the Nernst coefficient is defined in this way as the voltage you observe divided by the magnetic field and the temperature gradient. And that's what these light contours are here, these 500, 150, so forth. These are contours for this observation of the Nernst effect. This is from some talk by Naifuan Ong from Princeton, from where I copied this plot. And this Nernst effect is very large. If you thought it was going to come from say free electrons or some electron quasi particles in your system, the numbers you get here are way too large, seemingly, for that to work. And so what's been conjectured is that there are other degrees of freedom, vortices, which are responsible for this large effect. And I can't make as strong an argument as I'd like to, but this is, again, it's debated among the high TC superconducting folks, but Subir Sashdev and other people have conjectured that there is this behavior at low doping above this TC point might be well described by some quantum critical point. And the picture that some of these people have in mind is the following. Oops. So before, I had doping on the x-axis, which here I've substituted with some chemical potential, temperature on the y-axis, and then you imagine some third dimension, some coupling, effective coupling and some effective field theory. And that little trough here in the superconducting dome for these people is a symptom that, if you go off in this direction a little bit, you'll find a quantum critical point sitting down here, which is some insulating state. And these anomalously large Nernst effects, measurements that you see here at low doping above PC, are controlled by this point.
So now the idea is that even though you are at quantum temperatures low enough, that the quantum fluctuations are dominating the thermal.
Right. I think that's right.
What are your long range effects? All these be influenced by thermal properties. I mean, once your temperature adjusted becomes effective dimensionality. So I do not see how you can get the concept. Of course, you may have systems that are really influenced where the quantum fluctuations dominate definitely. Because you can, of course, extend from a quantum critical point, you can always extend to the non-zero temperature region and understand it from the environment of the quantum critical point. But it's never a real quantum phase transition in this region, simply because the Matsubara frequencies are this deep. It's just the dimensionality of the long range fluctuations that is different. I don't see how you can ever cure that by any parameter.
No, so then it's not that there's a quantum phase transition in finite temperature. The point is that at a quantum difference, like there are scales. Okay. So if you have a CFT at finite temperature, it's very different from a system with another scale.
It's all second order phase transition.
No, absolutely. Right, no, exactly, but the point about that's a quantum critical point, the CFT is a 2 plus 1 CFT, not just Euclidean CFT. So in a finite temperature equation, you can get a CFT on a low scale, but it's just a time correlation. At a quantum critical point, you get the whole Lorentz symmetry, 2 plus 1, at the end of the scale. So that constrains the finite temperature dynamics a lot, because there's a formula in Lorentz, you know, finite temperature. So in this window, what happens? Is that there's no other scale still. If you go too far away from the critical point at zero temperature, there's no other scale, okay? And then you have quantum particles and the whole different
sort of exactly. But you remember, what temperature realized fully?
What about this region? Is that it's a CFT at finite temperature and that constrains the dynamics a lot? That's
okay. I think this is an important point. Full symmetry as for 2-1. And I do not see how you can ever realize the symmetry at non-zero temperature because temperature effects will break the symmetry.
Sure, and we can model how they affect.
I know, but the thing is that an SO2-1 symmetric theory at finite temperature behaves very different than an SO2 symmetric theory at finite temperature. It will change, transport.
Okay, and you're saying they are neo-quantum phase transition and we look at the finite temperature effect as a symmetric breaking effect and describe it as a critical point. Okay.
All frequency dependent.
Okay, I understand what you mean. Is that what you find it?
So that was by way of introducing you to the experimental side of the story. Now I wanted to say a few words about the state of theory. So there are many, many lattice models in the condensed matter side here with these quantum critical points. So there's this Boson-Hubbard model, there are quantum Ising and rotor models. In fact, Zubir Sashtov's book is essentially a list of such models. It's very nicely written. I recommend you read it if you're interested in it. The effective field theory description of the fixed point, okay, it's a critical point, right? It's scale invariant. And there's sometimes, right, you have to get a little bit lucky, but there's sometimes when this field theory has a Lorentzian symmetry. Okay, but I don't mean a Lorentzian symmetry where the speed of light is, you know, 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. I mean a theory where you have some, you know, some particles which have some dispersion relation, which has some c, which is typically much less than, well, typically much less than 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. So a Lorentzian symmetry with a different speed of light.
Yeah.
It could be other things. There's this graphene, which has these relativistic fermions. There are different ways of getting this. All right, so given scale invariance, given the Lorentzian symmetry, if you get lucky, You get a full conformal symmetry group out of this. And sometimes this description is strongly interacting. I guess sort of a classic example here is this Wilson-Fisher fixed point, which they talk about in a field theory class, if you took a good one. So how do we analyze strongly interacting Lorentzian conformal field theories? That's the question at the bottom of this slide. And this is by way of motivation for my next slide, my sales pitch for the ADS-CFT correspondence. So if you had such a thing, and I'd like to think that in some cases you do in this condensed matter setup, this ADS-CFT correspondence provides a tool to study a class of strongly interacting field theories with Lorentzian symmetry in D dimensions by mapping these field theories to classical gravity in one to more dimensions, some holographic duality. So, I mean, given this, given such a duality, you get all kinds of nice things out of this. You get an equation of state, you get real-time correlation functions, and you also get to calculate things, transport properties, conductivities, diffusion constants, etc. And there are other things you get, too, that are nice that people have talked about, but I guess for the purposes of this talk, that's what I'm interested in. So I give you two programs. There's the ambitious program. There may be an example in this class of field theories which describes the quantum critical region of a real-world material, such as a high-TC superconductor. Okay. And I give you the less ambitious program, which is that I think these field theories are interesting, strongly coupled conformal field theories. I have a large class of them that I can study via the ADS-CFT correspondence, and by learning about this class of field theories, we might find universal features that could hold more generally. There's this eta over S, which this viscosity to entropy density, which people have talked about in the context of Rick physics and QCD, and maybe we'll find some other issues like this. Okay, so that's by way of motivation, and that's the end of the first part of my talk. Are there any questions before I go on?
So
lecture.
So the Wilson-Fisher fixed point is well-known trick electrons with all these strongly interacting beasts, but it's at least with using RG methods well understood.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that separates this class of problem from that?
So the Wilson-Fisher, I mean, it's a specific example, right? It's a specific example of a 5-4 field theory or an ON model. Here I have a whole other class of strongly interacting field theories for the purposes of this talk, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, which I claim control over, at least conjectural control through this ADS-CFT correspondence. All right, if you're happy with the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, then that's fine, but here's a whole other class of things.
Not just the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, but in general, RG methods can be used to approach these same kind of questions near second order fate. The question is really what do you gain from using ADS-CFT in
this? Wait a minute, a duality. I mean, it could be that some of the Wilson-Fisher, especially the ON fixed points that have been discussed way back, also have duals, but they're more complicated. And if they're developed, that might be useful.
Okay, but the Wilson-Fisher will not be in your class.
Actually, there have been some papers thinking about the duality for these ON models in terms of ADS-CFT correspondence. Polyakov and Igor Klebanov have written a paper about this.
But there's no relativistic interpretation for just the classical symmetry for
It has that. It has the ON rotation group, but it's also, you write it down as a relativistic field theory. It has the Lorentz symmetry. It flows to some fixed point, which then the symmetry gets enhanced to some conformal group. So you get the conformal group plus the ON symmetry. ON internal symmetry. More questions? All right, I'm going to go on to ADS-CFT. So for the experts in the audience, I apologize, but I'm going to try and make this very basic and begin even with strings and tell you some basic facts about string theory. They're open strings, strings with endpoints. They're closed strings, which are loops. Strings have two properties. Strings split with a likelihood G string. And strings also have a tension. So you multiply the length of the string times its tension, you get some energy. And the tension is, I write as 1 over L string squared, where L string is some characteristic length scale for the string. Okay. So that's it for introduction to string theory. Open strings, we go on to D-brains now. So open strings, you can have boundary conditions for these open strings. Open strings end on massive objects called D-brains. So if you're working in a perturbative limit where the string splitting amplitude is very small, where G-string is very small, these D-brains are non-perturbative objects. They tend to have masses, which scale is 1 over G-string. They have masses, which scale is G-string. And the last thing I wanted to just emphasize here, I don't know, most of you probably know this, but I'll just say it anyway, right? I mean, if you think of strings of time being some extra dimension here, you have a string traveling through space, it traces out some world sheet, so it's a, you know, one plus one dimensional object. And I took this next slide from a talk by Rob Pashansky, and I really like it because it kind of captures the essence of ADS-CFT duality without getting into any of the details or mathematics. So if you can make it out here, I have these squares at the end here. These are supposed to be a caricature of a D-brain. I have the world sheets which stretch between these two D-brains, so that's some string. And I can think about this in two different ways, right? I can think about a closed string traveling from one D-brain to another, or I can think about some open string traveling around the cylinder. Okay. And it's the same. It's the same. There's an open closed duality between these two. And I add two more details which, you know, underline why this is sort of, it gets at the core of what ADS-CFT duality is. The lowest closed string mode is graviton. So from this picture, I'm thinking about some gravitational interaction. Whereas the lowest open string mode is a gauge boson, so from this picture I'm thinking about some gauge theory interaction. So there you have it. In a single slide, the sort of essence of gauge gravity duality without any math. So the original correspondence, maybe some of you who were here for Larry's and Ed's talk probably saw some slide like this, and many of you know this very, very well. But let me just go over it. So we have the original ADS-CFT correspondence, maximally supersymmetric SUN Yang-Mills theory in 3 plus 1 dimensions, dual to this type 2B closed string theory on ADS-5 cross S-5. So the idea is you have some stack of D-brains, 3 plus 1 dimensional D-brains. And you can think about the open strings between them, which give you this gauge theory, or you can think about the closed strings that go between them and the back reaction of the D-brains on the geometry, which curves space in this way to give you this nice symmetric space. All you really need to know about ADS-5, it's a hyperboloid with a time direction and a boundary, five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And you know what a two-sphere is, you know what a five-sphere is. All right. So the first two entries in the dictionary are these two that map this duality. So on the gauge theory side, I have a G Yang-Mills coupling constant for the gauge theory, and I have N, the number of colors for this SUN group. So I can join this together in some Tuft coupling lambda. That maps to the ratio of curvature of these ADS and S5 spaces to the string scale. And I also have G Yang-Mills, which maps on the other side to the string coupling. Okay. So one important point for this gauge theory is that it's a conformal theory for all values of lambda. So I can go from the perturbative limit, where I understand what this guy is, to some very strong coupling limit. And how does this work? Well, what's usually done to make this type 2B string theory useful is we first take this n goes to infinity limit, this Tuft double scaling limit, with lambda fixed. That means G string goes to zero. It means strings don't split. So I'm thinking about classical strings. Okay. And the next limit that's often taken to make this side useful is to take lambda very large. So in other words, the radius of curvature of these spaces gets very large to the string scale. And in that limit, string theory reduces to a gravitational theory. Okay. All right. So that's the original correspondence. And to think about these 2 plus 1 dimensional condensed matter systems I talked about at the beginning, well, let's introduce a 2 plus 1 dimensional example of this ADS-CFT correspondence. So there exist many, many, many of these ADS-CFT dualities at this point. I've given you the original one, and I'm going to give you the next best known, the so-called M2 brain theory now, but you should keep in mind that there are countably many of these, maybe even more. So we consider, to motivate this duality, let's, instead of thinking about super Yang-Mills in 3 plus 1 dimensions, let's think about it in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, so we have some coupling constant, G Yang-Mills. So we're in 2 plus 1 dimensions, the coupling is relevant, has dimension 1. So I have some effective coupling, which depends on the scale at which I want to think about the physics. At low energies, this coupling gets very strong, and people think that this gauge theory runs to an interacting superconformal fixed point at low energies. So not just a conformal fixed point, but a superconformal fixed point. And moreover, there's a conjecture in the literature that's now about 10 years old, but which seems quite reasonable, that this IR fixed point at large n, and the Stiff coupling limit, is well described by this ADS-CFT correspondence by 11-dimensional supergravity in this particular curved background, this ADS-4 cross S7. So one important difference between this guy and the ADS-5 cross S5 duality I described on the previous slide is that there's no equivalently tunable TUF parameter lambda here. We're at a fixed point for this duality to work. So it makes a little bit more obscure what the microscopic degrees of freedom are at that IR fixed point. All right. So going on, I wanted to cover some more sort of basic stuff about ADS-CFT. And this slide contains, I guess, the central idea. If you understand this last equation on this slide, you understand most of what we're doing. So here we are. We have ADS. This is my cartoon picture of ADS. Basically a half space. It's some kind of hyperboloid, but it has a boundary here. It has a radial direction z, so the boundary sits at z equals 0. And the idea behind this holographic duality is that things that happen in the bulk get projected onto the boundary in a way that we can understand. Well, so what do? If we start on the field theory side with some operator O of x, and say we have some source, phi naught, for O, field theory side. The idea in this duality is that we identify phi naught not only as the source for this operator, but also as the boundary value of a supergravity field in this ADS-5 space. Okay. So if you go ahead and you evaluate the partition function for gravity as a function of these boundary values for these supergravity fields, you at the same time get a generating functional for the connected correlators in the field theory. Okay, that's the sort of central point of this ADS-CFT correspondence, this bottom line, which, I don't know, you look at it and to begin with, it doesn't seem to say too much, but, or maybe it's a little bit difficult to appreciate, but if you understand this, you understand most of what we're doing.
So what governs the partition here if you don't have a fixed point, if you don't have a variable lambda or a radius?
N.
N governs the one of the extensions, but what governs the gravity of the little part of the system?
There's nothing else. It's just L times because it's the radius of the
so there's no. So why is this gravity not specific? What is this small
part? N theory, actually.
It's empty. There's not whatever the measure.
So there is no parameter. It's not gravity. It's M theory.
Right. Low energy.
Why is it low energy?
ADS is small. It's large in accidents.
Depends on the question.
Well, that is true if you do it in ADS5 process 5. Depends on the question you're asking.
But you also have lambda.
Right.
Yeah, but that's an advantage. That's because the time to be string theory has a bit of one that you can vary.
So any question, lambda is big enough, so gravity approximation is still that's so true.
If you take a massive string state, then the dimension of that object is big. But this is, it's always like that. If you ask in terms of organizing your field theory by operator dimensions, then small operator dimension is always gravity. And then
you're saying, fine. But here, there is the disadvantage of having to represent theory.
Yes.
Which has no small. No looping thing.
Right.
No alpha line.
It's an alpha time expansion.
And therefore, no theory.
Well, you can still do an energy expansion.
Right? Yeah.
So that's what you left. Instead of having a double series, you only get a single series in my way.
It's hard to see the connection between the UV, SUN, super Yang-Mills theory and this low-energy superconformal. All right, so I have this thing at the bottom, right? So here's my generating functional on the field theory side, and I can calculate it on the gravity side by evaluating this partition function with these particular values for the boundary fields. That's again essentially what I was saying on the previous slide. N equals infinity means we are in some classical limit. We can evaluate this C gravity through a saddle point method. We solve Einstein's equations in this ADS space. We plug in the solutions to this gravitational action. We call the result W. And evaluate it on shell, W only has support at Z equals zero. Just you can express it in terms of these boundary fields. And this is sort of central idea in these old papers that began the ADS-CFT duality that underlined it by Maldacena, Klebanov, Polyakov, Gubser, and Witten. All right. So that's the workhorse, and then I have to tell you a few more entries in the dictionary. So if you're interested, for example, in an operator of the stress-energy tensor, it turns out that the bulk field that corresponds to that are fluctuations in the metric, okay? Maybe not so surprising given the definition of the stress tensor. If you're interested in a conserved current in the boundary theory, that's dual to the vector potential of a gauge field in the bulk, okay? And so then by evaluating classical gravity for a solution to Einstein's equations, you can produce generating functionals for all of these Green's functions, the one-point functions of the stress tensor, for two-point functions of the stress tensor and current, so forth. And now we're getting a bit closer to the non-equilibrium physics, which is the subject of this workshop. I should add an important caveat here, which will become a little bit more important as we go on, that we're computing correlators of a global current here. It's not a gauged current. And if you want to reinterpret the results for a gauge current, you have to think about this gauge field as being very weak or equivalently ignoring Coulomb interactions. All right.
So this is supposed to be three-dimensional CFT, supposed to be an isolated
this, yes, I believe. I think. I don't know. I think it's isolated. Maybe some marginal directions. They might, I don't know. It's an interesting.
Show me a condensed matter cube that has its own symmetry.
That's some of the SO5 symmetry. Well, I had an impression that it was important to have an isolated fixed time for condensed matter application.
I haven't heard that.
You can have a sequence one of some of the things that are very common and therefore isolated. And there's a space transition constant stuff, which happens when some random operator comes out. So, I mean, what happens is that most of the lab samples that we can generate correspond to isolated critical quantity, but that doesn't mean that they have.
All right. I'll give you the gravitational action because I can for this 11-dimensional gravity. I can't do it for radius 5 cross S5 in one line, but I can in 11 dimensions, so I'll do it. It was standard Einstein-Hilbert term, which is familiar, and then this other term, which is maybe not so familiar to most of you. This is some four-form field strength. Today, we don't need this full thing. We can focus on a four-dimensional consistent truncation of the 11-dimensional action. We throw out the 7-sphere, and we keep only the gravitational degrees of freedom on ADS4 along with a gauge field, which comes from some Kluze-Klein reduction of this F4 and some off-diagonal components of the metric. And also, I have this cosmological constant term, which means asymptotically it's anti-de Sitter's thing. This appears from a Kaluza-Klein reduction of this theory on ADS4 cross S7, or Freund-Rubin compactification. It was worked out, I guess, by Duff and Pope in the early 80s. With a non-vanishing, That's right. All right, and I should add that although I've just talked about ADS4 cross S7 here, there are many ADS4 CFT3 dualities which have such a consistent truncation to this Einstein-Hilbert term plus electricity and magnetism, E1 gauge field. All right. So one solution to this Einstein-Maxwell theory is a dionic black hole. So that's a black hole with both electric and magnetic charges. And I'll give you some more entries in the dictionary. The Hawking temperature of the black hole is the temperature of the field theory. The magnetic field of the black hole is the magnetic field of the field theory. And the electric field of the black hole becomes the charge density of the field theory. So by studying this gravity theory in ADS4, you can learn about the associated quantum critical point or conformal field theory as a function of temperature, magnetic field, and charge density. Okay. Oh, and this is just a slide to convince you that we have nice, explicit, simple solution. So this is the dionic black hole background. This is the line element for that black hole. There's a magnetic field. There's an electric field from the charges of the black hole. Here's the temperature written in terms of, say, the magnetic field and the electric field. And there's also an entropy density, which comes from the area of the black hole. All right. So I guess since this is a lecture, I should do a little calculation. It'd probably be easier if I did this on the blackboard, but this is simple enough that you can probably just see it. Why does electric field become charge density? How do we use this formula for converting the gravity partition function into this generator for correlation functions? So consider this vector potential. I said that was dual to the current. Okay. If I consider the near boundary behavior, okay, the behavior near the boundary of ADS space, I expand in small z. There's a leading term, which is going to be the source for the corresponding operator in the field theory, and then there's some subleading term, d mu. So on shell, the relevant part of the supergravity action reduces to this boundary term, so I just integrate f squared by parts, and I get some boundary term. And the part that's relevant is just this leading term, at dz at. Okay. So the radial electric field at the boundary, right, that's just going to be the z derivative of this t component of the vector potential, which is nothing but what I've called bt here in this expansion, this b sub t. All right, so by our prescription, right, what is rho? Rho is the time component of the current, which is the partial derivative of this generating functional by the source term, AT. So I look at what happens here. What do I get? I get BT, right, which I said was the electric field. And so this charge density is nothing but some constant times the electric field. Clear? The B field, by contrast, is a source term. It's the leading component of A that gives you the B field. All right. I mean, so this is a baby example, but this gives you a sense of how you would go on and compute two-point functions and so forth. All right, so that concludes the second part of the talk, and now The last part I want to talk about results. I'll pause for questions again.
No. So first you turn on the charge density,
but you have to get away from the density, right?
Yes.
So does this allow you to go around it from critical point to one critical point to another?
Again, I think.
Now I look at view, basically, on one of the slides, on the previous slides. So I thought by changing view, you're able to go from, you're able to cross from the critical point.
Yeah, I don't want to go into one phase or the other phase. I want to stay in some intermediate region where neither order parameter for the particular phases is a good description of the theory.
But would it be a way to, in principle, go from one phase to another by just changing them?
I think to go from one phase to the other, I need to do something. I need some other knob to turn. I need to be able to access some phase transition also in the gravitational theory. So maybe if you actually see a phase transition in the gravity theory, you would also be able to see these phase transitions in the field theory. There are no phase transitions yet in what I'm talking about. And I have just some conformal field theory, and I have some knobs that get me a little bit away from it, but in a continuous way, not through any non-analyticity. Yeah?
That's related to David Fermat. I mean, at the end, you have just a hypothesis about equivalence of two partition functions, one in classical gravity, the other in a field theory. Mm-hmm. String theory, actually, on this level, does not enter anymore.
That's right.
Has one ever tried to prove this equivalence? I mean, it's of course already proven the long distance limit directly for the partition functions.
So I guess there are many answers to this question.
A lot of things one can apply that one not.
I mean, the first answer is that people have been trying to prove this correspondence for 10 years to some extent, and we haven't done it yet. But there are a lot of... The second answer is that there's a lot of evidence that this correspondence goes beyond gravity. You can look at non-perturbative objects, bigger objects, objects with really heavy mass.
If one could prove that in the long-distance limit period.
Okay.
Of course, this is much less ambitious than proving the full duality in a string theory. It's just this statement about the long-distance properties of partition functions. Has that not been tried? This would be...
It has been tried, and as far as I know, no one has succeeded. Yeah. No?
I think that's a dream. As long as we don't prove duality in this lifetime, maybe in a time before, it looks like it's there. The method is to solve both. All one time, you can start the other and solve both sides exactly.
You know, I mean, my question was just if the usual proof is not, you know, one wants not to prove something too ambitious, right? If one would just
really restrict it,
how could you possibly do the long?
How could you possibly prove it? You don't have a formula in the thing. Or really.
Yeah, but
so you might have to start with a gauge size, which is one fine, construct M theory, which is.
No, my idea was just not passing by a string and actually, but yeah. I can do it directly. But okay, so this is...
It's certainly interesting.
I just would, you know, just very restrict oneself just on the long-distance behavior of these two expressions for the partition functions and try to find it.
One might be well-defined, the other one is any expression in
theory.
Both
are well-defined partition functions.
Gravity theory.
No, that's just a classical statement. One classical, one is classical, yeah. And the other one is a well-defined partition function. One could try just to get to the infinite distance limit and try to see if one can really...
Look, the way people do that is that since it's a conformal theory, what you do is you take a list of the dimensions of all operators.
All the operators, all the symmetric classifications.
So this was known for supergravity, in fact, pretty much as soon as the ASCFT came out. And this was a calculation that was done at weak coupling and then extrapolated because of the
objects in the trap with some detection.
Some potential operating. Well, it was the full star supergravity phase. Everything was super.
Yes.
Everything, all the fire, all the math. All the math was good.
So you only the long distance.
Yeah, you only the math was good.
Right, but since they're protected by supersymmetry, well, it's still a highly non-triggered statement.
Well, not everything, however, is protected by supersymmetry.
Once we get to finite temperature, two-point functions. So now I want to talk a little bit about results in the last few minutes here. So by considering small fluctuations around the background values of a mu and g mu nu, as I've argued before, we can compute two-point functions of the stress tensor with global currents with each other, and these two-point functions through standard linear response theory give you transport coefficients and conductivities and so forth. And here I've written a bunch of these transport coefficients in this matrix. So J here is the charge current. Q is the heat current, which is related to some momentum current by the following subtraction. E is an electric field or applied voltage. Delta T is some temperature gradient. And then these things are I guess, relatively mundane, familiar transport coefficients. We have sigma, the conductivity, so it's just, you know, part of Ohm's law is sitting in here. Alpha is some thermoelectric coefficient, which gives you, you know, the current response to a heat gradient, and then kappa is some heat conductivity. And so we can calculate all of these as a function of temperature, charge density, and magnetic field for this particular conformal field theory. So, for example, the conductivity, by Ohm's law, right, it's nothing but the current divided by the electric field. And in this gravitational setup, what it is it's the bulk magnetic field divided by the bulk electric field, and the limit z goes to zero. So, you know, the script characters here are for bulk values, and the non-script characters are for the boundary values. Okay. I've gone ahead and defined these holomorphic combinations, holomorphic and anti-holomorphic combinations. Oh, there should be a minus here. Sorry for that. It just makes the notation a little bit nicer, at least I think so. And this notation, Ohm's law, becomes the following, and sigma plus minus is this B plus minus divided by E plus minus. You can forget about the indices to some extent. All right, so now I want to tell you about some neat results that come from this. The first is this electric magnetic duality. So the action for an abelian gauge field, right, in four dimensions takes this form, and it has electric magnetic duality. If I send E to B and the magnetic field to minus the electric field and I invert the coupling, I get the same action back. I get a self-duality. Well, a duality with a different coupling. And on the boundary, what this duality does, it switches the charge density and magnetic field. And I should be clear from the previous slide, right, where I said that sigma plus minus was B over E. It sends sigma to minus 1 over sigma. So there's a natural action of electric magnetic duality, or S duality, on the conductivity, which is kind of neat. And you see some discussions of this in the condensed matter literature, but I think this is one of the cleaner instances of S duality acting on a conductivity in the literature. This duality has a neat implication. So consider the case where the charge density and the magnetic field vanish. Okay, then S duality becomes a self duality. Ignoring the action of the coupling constant, which we can do because it's essentially a classical theory, so we can just rescale G at this level. And because of this electric magnetic duality, right, E over B must be minus B over E. So what does that mean? It means that sigma plus minus is a constant. It means that sigma is a constant independent of the frequency. So this is not just the DC conductivity, this is the frequency at any frequency. And in terms of components, that's sigma xx. Sigma xx is just 1 over g squared. That's sort of...
So you can also say that e squared plus b squared is 0.
Yes. There's no energy in the electromagnetic field. There's also a black hole at some finite temperature, so...
A kind of gauge.
You're worried about me dividing out 0 over 0? Is that the...
Some total energy in the electromagnetic field is 0.
That's right. But that's... Okay, but wait a second. I'm not sure exactly what you're asking, but let me just go on. EX plus IEY.
So this is itself a self-field field.
Well, so this is the background values of the field. Okay, that's maybe what's confusing. So there's a background value of... Right, so there's a background value of rho and b. And then b plus minus is, it's the b field not perpendicular to the surface, but parallel to the surface in the fourth dimension. It's what gives you the current in the fourth dimension. So these are not necessarily zero, but these are, and under S-duality, these are switched. It gives you a self-duality, but then small perturbations of that just flip. The fluctuations. It's a little slick. I wanted to fit it on one slide, but it's right.
G here is still in the arbitrary,
G is the coupling constant associated with the field theory. It actually does take on a very specific value for this particular ADS4 cross S7 duality. It's something that scales as the number of colors to the 3/2 times some other factors. Or is it -3/2? No. Yeah, 1 over g squared is n to the 3/2. G is dimensionless.
So sigma, this is in a four-dimensional boundary theory.
This is in a 2 plus 1 dimensional boundary theory where the conductivities are dimensionless. Okay. So lots of other really neat results here, which I keep you guys too long, but let me just go through a few of them. There's this nice small frequency hydrodynamic behavior for the conductivity. So now we're going to go to non-zero rho and non-zero b and consider small frequencies. So frequency small compared to the temperature rho and b. And the conductivity, the sigma plus, takes the following form, where omega c is a cyclotron frequency, gamma is some damping for that cyclotron frequency, sigma q is some... maybe I can call it a DC conductivity. Let's see, what can I point out about this? One neat thing about this is that under S-duality, you know, the poles in this go to zeros and the zeros go to poles in sort of precisely the right way to agree with this omega C and gamma. The structure here is not so much fixed by ADS-CFT. The structure here is fixed more by hydrodynamics, except, and then the microscopic theory, this ADS-CFT, will give you the state variables. It will give you the energy density epsilon. It will give you the pressure P, the entropy density, and this conductivity sigma Q. And I guess the last thing I point out, there's this nice paper by Sean Hartnell and Pavel Kovtun where they showed that in the limit, omega goes to zero, but with non-zero charge density and magnetic field, you get a Hall conductivity in this theory, and indeed, that DC limit here recovers this rho over B formula, this Hall conductivity. So a lot of this structure here is in some sense more general. You expect from relativistic hydrodynamics to get the structure for the conductivity, but particular values depend on the microscopic theory. And then you can if there are these nice numeric results. So this again, this is specific to ADS4 across S7. This is no longer at small frequency. This is at arbitrary frequency for some various values of the magnetic field and the charge density. And this is a plot of the absolute value of sigma in the complex frequency plane. So the white spots are poles and the black spots are zeros. That's sort of a nice picture, right? As you increase the magnetic field here from left to right, the poles sort of shift around this arch. And then by the time you get over here, this is the S-dual configuration of this guy. The zeros and the poles switch as they should. Right? Black becomes white, white becomes black. All right. A little bit more. I presume on your patience a little bit more. This slide, again, is not specific to ADS-4 across S7, this ADS-CFT. This is a little bit more general, but it's consistent with this ADS-CFT framework. You find these ward identities. They're essentially ward identities for the other transport coefficients. So given sigma, you can calculate the thermoelectric coefficient at arbitrary frequency. And then given alpha, you can compute the heat conductivity at arbitrary frequency via these formula. So we derived this in our paper from ADS-CFT, but I believe that they're more general. They just come from ward identities. And they rely on the following assumptions, which I've written down here, that the gravitational interactions are unimportant, that we're ignoring these electromagnetic interactions, the field theory is Lorentz invariant, and the equilibrium state is time reversal invariant, rotationally symmetric, reflectionally invariant. I'm not sure I really mean this one. All right, given that there's a B field. I don't know why I'm saying that. And then I talked a little bit about the Nernst effect at the beginning. So the Nernst effect is also related to these transport coefficients. It's the E field, the electric field or voltage in response to a temperature gradient, and it's related to the inverse conductivity multiplied by the thermoelectric coefficient. And this Nernst coefficient is basically the yx component of theta divided by the magnetic field, or in complex combinations. So I can't really do justice to the next couple of slides because they're from that last paper that I mentioned at the introduction, this last paper about impurities, and I wanted to save something I was asked to talk at the end of the month, and I wanted to save a little bit for that. So I didn't talk about the impurity paper at all, but I just mentioned here as a teaser that you can actually try and compare some of these effects with high TC superconductor measurements.
How do you model impurity?
Yeah, that's a long story. There are two ways that essentially just one way that we did it. The way we did it was we introduced a random potential, a weak random potential, coupled to some relevant operator in the field theory, and we treated it perturbatively. Of this relevant operator, yeah. But there's a second way that Sean and Subir Sashtov and Pavel and Marcus Mueller, where they looked at this from a hydrodynamic point of view, they broke translational invariance and introduced some impurity scattering time. And in the hydrodynamic limit, at least, you get the following formula for this Nernst coefficient, which depends on this impurity scattering time. And then when rho equals zero, this formula simplifies dramatically to that. And just as a teaser, again, I'm not doing justice to this because I don't have time, but here are some plots of the Nernst effect for, this is a high TC superconductor. It's the one I described at the beginning, this strontium-doped lanthanum cuprate, very close to this critical doping factor of 1/8. So maybe there's some sense in which this has close to rho equals zero. This is a plot from Naifuan Ong. These are measurements from Naifuan Ong's group. So what's being plotted on the horizontal axis, I have temperature. On the vertical axis, I have it's essentially a magnetic field. You have to worry about magnetization now because this is a real material, and the cooler colors are lower Nernst signals, and the warmer colors are higher Nernst coefficients. This is another superconductor. This is an organic superconductor from a paper by Arjang Ardavan and collaborators. It's the same thing on the axes, the magnetic field versus temperature. The warmer colors are larger Nernst coefficients. And this is a plot from a paper by Sean and I using our model of impurities where we've coupled a relevant scalar to some weak random potential. And we've put in some units here, which we think might be right, although we're not really sure. So this is magnetic field in Tesla. We haven't accounted for magnetization. This is temperature in Kelvin. And it's sort of similar as you go up. If you look at this region, down in here, slightly above TC, at small magnetic fields where the hydrodynamics are valid, you see a similar sort of behavior where the Nernst coefficient gets larger as you go up and to the left. Oh, we have to pick a speed of light, and that's a tunable parameter here. We picked one. We didn't do a lot of work with that. We just picked the easiest one in some sense. And
another one needs to be different order of magnitude for T.
It shouldn't shift. It probably these numbers are much larger, I think, really, than these numbers here. I think that's probably real.
Whenever you approach some quantity that gets large, two-dimensional plane. I'm just curious. I mean, how? Just imagine something that is peaked in a two-dimensional plane, and you cut out as you approach it, and you put it in the upper left corner. It will always look a little bit like that. So is there something
You say if it, whenever I have a peak here and I look at this corner, it will look like this. Sure. Sure. But I don't think this plot is completely void of information. We can't go higher than this because that takes us out of this hydrodynamic limit. And we can't go to the left for the same reason.
You cannot. Yeah. Can I say one point? So there's a TC, so where the maximum is on both of these plots, that's in the superconducting phase. Okay? So at about in the 27, in the plot on the left, the TC is about 27. Okay? So everything to the left of that plot, there's a condensate. And so that's not something that you should want to describe using this image. So you have to be... where you expect the critical bit, where that bump was, that dip from the phase diagram which showed us at the beginning, that was just above, that was around this 30-40 region. So the region you'd expect the CFT to have influence is precisely just above TC and the low level of the where it is roughly.
Why is normally that?
There's a natural dimension of being able to temperature.
Yeah, it's small compared to the temperature. In this plot, everything is... This, I think they... Well, no, they go as high as they can. This is, what, 16 Tesla or something?
The region which is non-magnetic field is there.
The region which... Oh, I see what you're asking. Yeah, I think the region... Well... No, I think all of this is probably low magnetic field because the temperature is much higher.
In what way are real world superconductors and Lorentz invariant in the sense that we could need here?
Well, so I guess one way of talking about this is in terms of Coulomb interactions. If you have a Coulomb interaction between electrons, that's going to happen at the real speed of light. That's going to break whatever Lorentz invariance at this lower speed of light we have. So one way of talking about breaking of this Lorentz symmetry is in terms of how important Coulomb interactions are. And I don't know, I get the feeling that different people have different feelings of how important Coulomb interactions are for these high TC superconductors.
Well, this one happens to see these gaps most explicitly in this real world
event. I thought we do for this super, yeah, is that right? Yeah.
Does one actually see these gapless modes directly on probable system?
So I believe there's evidence for some scaling. So the way they interact with CDC is that one can scale the temperature. And I believe that that is observed in some of the information.
The correlation possible. Yeah, directly probable. Indirectly probable. Yes, we will probable.
in your calculation, you still have to take some large n limit.
Yeah, this is at large n.
So is there this is quantity independent of n, or did you pick a value?
This quantity, I think, what did we do? Did we fit? I think this quantity is independent of g squared. Oh, no, well, that's what we did. We fit the conductivity. So the conductivity, so g squared, it's this g squared, right, which depends on n to the 3 halves. And we said that that was a conductivity, right? And then we said, well, actually, the conductivity in these real world materials tends to have some characteristic value, which, if you remember that plot I showed way, way back, what is it, this E over E squared over 2H, H bar over 2E, that's not the right one. This value. Some conductivity, which is 1 over that. So that's how we scaled n out of the problem.
So what is that in terms of
what is it in terms of, well, what value of n? Well, that's a good question. I don't think we...
It's not going to be 1,000.
Well, a third would be good.
We should look at that. I don't think we looked at that. Did you look? No.
I really think in that plot there wasn't an end, because it was just n has to be
down. Oh, you say because?
It was sigma over sigma 0.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I guess tau impurity in our calculation doesn't depend on sigma.
Why can't we go over the temperature zero? I thought we had agreed that temperature effects are always violating the we have had a mapping between temperature and the gravity in the field zero.
We can go to t equals zero, but then we also have to go to b equals zero. You have to keep B small compared to T.
Okay, and then it looks completely different.
I think, so what region do we get then? I mean, we can go a little back in here, I guess, maybe.
Because the other pictures have some non-trivial behavior when the temperature really goes to zero.
No, but that's a phase transition.
That's a phase transition.
Which I don't capture it in any case.
That's the problem. When you put the inverse to the left of the bottom right figure as the line is going up here in the figure. The line is going
this line, I guess this yellow line is the phase transition line, I think. And this line is some guide to the eye. I don't know what the significance of that line is.
It's a vertical line at about 28.
Oh, it's a vertical line? Okay. Doesn't depend on that?
I don't think it's that strongly.
Yeah. All right. That's it. I just have a summary here. You know, I tried to convince you that ADS-CFT is a useful tool for studying strongly interacting field theories. You get equations of state, correlation functions, and transport properties. The hope is that these field theories might be relevant for understanding real-world condensed matter systems. As a little teaser, we already did this. We wrote a paper about this last month about impurities. That's an important question, which there's more to say about. And I think some of it will be talked about at the conference. And then also, the thing I'm most interested in working on next along these lines is getting away from this quantum critical point. Can we find supergravity solutions that actually have phase transitions, where you can think about not just moving sort of up in this diagram I had at the beginning to finite temperature, but back and forth as you tune some critical coupling in the field theory. All right, that's it. Thanks.
Didn't talk about shear viscosity at all. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I didn't talk about shear viscosity. I guess because I did this a long time ago. I don't know. I didn't find a place for it in the talk. I did this, I guess, back in 2002 when I was here. You can calculate the shear viscosity for this theory, and it takes the universal value, you know, h bar for 4 pi kb. And then I think also there was a paper by Omid, by Sarimi, where he looked at the this theory at non-zero charge density, and it's still, I believe, the same, saturates the same value.
Yeah. I mean, one of the simplest quantum phase transitions that are probably in your class are just bosons. Just bosons, and the transition is at zero temperature, the transition is between zero density and non-zero density. Now, of course, you know non-zero density is the Einstein quantum phase. So in two dimensions, you find that actually the long distance behavior is really governed by a relativistic theory of zero temperature.
Okay.
Which is a bit surprising, but it's true. The normalization group shows that. And you have a real, very simple system, just one complex field, one complex boson field with a relativistic effective action that has SO2, 1 invariance. Could you construct corresponding theory, and because there you can compute a lot of things and can test things explicitly. Would that be possible? Or do you really need supersymmetry and things like that in order to make any reasonable conjecture what your
supersymmetry often makes things much easier, that you're guaranteed stability. You don't have to worry about, you know, tachyons and instabilities as much. It's always been an interesting question whether you can design one of these ADS-CFT correspondences to correspond to some theory that you can already treat.
That's fine, you can compute in large and n copies of bosons, that's even simpler.
But then you have trivial, then you have irrespective of the dimension, irrespective of the same
intensity. There are not two dimensions, it's not so completely.
Large n doesn't depend on it.
Well, but we still have this longer one, this feature that it becomes a relativistic theory, even though you start it with a non-relativistic boson, so for this theory. So the coupling never becomes completely irrelevant. So if it's a non-trivial theory, and trivial exponents may be relatively simple, but at least you can compute. And I mean, it would be very nice if you had some simple example that one can test it in some way with knowledge that you can get from other means, from statistical physics.
Oh, I agree. I haven't done it. It's an interesting question.
You know, the conjecture for the simple...
People have tried to apply this ADS4 CFT3 correspondence to the ON model at large n.
Okay, that's
it more or less works what people have. I mean, some it works to some extent. What do they get? These higher spin theories?
But the other problem is for the matrix model is n squared. There they probably are in some cases.
There's a recent paper about this by some Japanese folks who have a numerical simulation of some matrix model, some D0 brain quantum mechanics where they...
No, this is the standard of the FSS.
Oh,
That was the one. Yeah, no, there's one of, I don't think it, the one yesterday, that there's one a few weeks ago.
Yes,
this is.
Is that what they put 6 months ago?
No, but there was a, they had a talk.
Oh, it was a talk, that's right, it was a talk.
And what do they do?
They don't have a similarity.
They do SU14 matrix theory.
SU14?
As far as they can go.
Oh, you mean they're doing it there?
They do it numerically, it's matrix quantum mechanics. And then the hard part is that there's so many fermions around, integrating out those fermions costs a lot of computer time. And then they try to map to the very low temperature medium where they're supposed to match the matrix to a black hole. They almost get there, but not quite.
Well, they claimed a victory.
They're almost there in that they cannot really approach the ultra low temperature regime. They can see that they're starting to match on the black hole stuff, but they cannot reproduce the full curvature the numeric just gets on. That's a bit
It's they match the energy density, the scaling of the energy density with temperature, strong coupling. That they match the energy density, the scaling of the energy density with temperature, that strong coupling, or. Okay.